Kamala out, Julian blames the media. The lone Texan still running for president on coverage of people of color. That story and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. After Kamala Harris's decision to suspend her candidacy in the race for the White House, we'll have more of what fellow Democratic presidential contender Julian Castro calls a double standard in the presidential race. Wildfires caused by downed power lines, a thing of the past? A team at Texas A&M comes up with technology that could be a game changer. Plus, a PolitiFact check on Latino wages and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us on this fourth day of December, a day which may prove historic as a House panel in Washington undertakes a debate on articles of impeachment. For his part, President Trump appears content to spend this moment playing the role of disruptor on the European stage. It's a curious and somewhat awkward position he finds himself in, for his most natural ally is Boris Johnson, the Conservative Prime Minister of the UK, who's in a battle to retain his position and his insistence on Brexit. Elections are set there on December 12th. According to the New York Times, Mr. Trump's aides have warned him to keep his distance from the British Prime Minister, lest a full-throated endorsement backfire, hurting Johnson's candidacy. It's a bit of three-dimensional chess, I suppose, but that's politics. Factors beyond the candidate's control often intervene and sink those who once upon a time might have been considered among those most likely to succeed. Take our own presidential sweepstakes. California Senator Kamala Harris seemed to have all sorts of great credentials, but when it came to one of the most important of all, she ran out. Cash on the barrelhead to fuel her campaign. Yesterday, after Harris suspended her presidential bid, the last remaining Texan in the race, Julian Castro, took note of the complexion of the remaining field of candidates and proceeded to call out the media. And in so doing, apparently had a rather good fundraising day himself. Here to discuss what Castro said and the larger dynamic of the presidential race going forward, Sonia Garcia. She is professor of political science at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. Professor Garcia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Let's talk a little bit about what Julian Castro, who used to be mayor of your fair city, had to say about the way that his colleague Kamala Harris announced her exit from the race. He said that the media has a kind of double standard when it comes to when it came to treating her. What did he mean by that?
Well, I teach courses on gender and politics, and I've actually co-authored a book on Latinas in public office, and so I certainly understand what he means as far as a double standard. It's no surprise that women, especially women of color, are treated in a different standard. Unlike men, unlike even white women, and so there's this extra scrutiny placed on women of color, and so I certainly understand, especially the way the media covered Kamala Harris's campaign, that she did not have a message when she clearly did, that she was flip-flopping, when in some cases when it came to healthcare, she just, narrowed her views on healthcare, but the way the media scrutinizes women of color, and in this case, Kamala Harris, it was another burden that she had to, another obstacle that she had to overcome, which made it much more difficult for her to then raise funds and to continue to get support.
Was it the media that did this? I mean, the reason I'm saying this is because I can recall after that first debate performance, the media was singing her praises. I mean, if there was anyone who seemed to be a clear winner, at least in terms of the nattering nabobs, as Spiro Agnew once said, it was Kamala Harris.
You're right. And after that first debate, I believe she was second as far as in her success. But it was very short term. It was very short term, and so that's where that additional scrutiny then is placed. And that's not to say that the media doesn't place scrutiny on all presidential candidates. But when it comes to women of color, again, the expectations are unrealistic, right? I don't believe we hold the same standards when it comes to white men or even white women. And so, and even in the case of Julian Castro, I believe the media has also been very, in some ways, unfair as far as his success in the candidacy. He's an excellent candidate. Kamala Harris, an excellent candidate, clearly qualified. And so, you know, it struck me, right, because you have this slate of candidates, the most diverse we've ever had. It was very exciting, but yet it's no surprise. And who are the top contenders? It's white men or white women.
It's my understanding that after Julian Castro made his comments, he proceeded to have the best fundraising day of this past quarter. What do you make of that?
Well, that's the next question, right? Now that Kamala Harris has stepped down, who are her supporters going to then turn to? There is concern by many, you know, within the Latino community and the African-American community that the people of color are starting to dwindle down considerably. We have Cory Booker and now Julian Castro. So that's the next question. Will Kamala Harris's supporters continue to support people of color like Julian Castro and Cory Booker? Or, again, the emphasis is so much on the electability, right? And that's where... that's where both of these candidates are having some trouble as well. You know, on the one hand, I think there is going to be continued support for Julian Castro and Cory Booker. Whether or not that lasts, we'll see. We have yet to see. At minimum, we need to have people of color on this slate of candidates, if anything, to address issues that are most important to Latinos and minorities and women of color and people of color generally.
Sonia Garcia is professor of political science at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. Professor, thanks for talking with us on The Standard.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you.
Twas the night before Thanksgiving. Residents in and around Port Neches in East Texas jolted out of their sleep by an explosion at a local chemical plant. Just over 12 hours later, another blast erupted from the still-burning facility. The two explosions didn't cause any loss of life, thankfully, but did send workers to nearby hospitals to be treated for injuries and shattered windows at nearby businesses and homes. Almost a week later, local officials now say the fires have finally been extinguished, but emergency crews are remaining on site to monitor the situation. For more on the latest and what we know and don't, Jacob Dick, he's been covering this story for the Beaumont Enterprise. Jacob, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What actually exploded?
That is kind of been hard to narrow down, but what we have been told is that the fire and explosion centered around a butadiene processor. Butadiene's used in the production of synthetic rubber materials and plastics. Mm-hmm. And that's about as far as we've been told. And then from there, it spread into several different chemical holding vessels.
Okay, let's talk about this chemical plant. TPC, what's known about this company?
TPC has two different locations, one in Houston, one there in Port Neches. It is privately held. It doesn't have public investors or anything like that. And as far as the company, I never came across it a lot in my day-to-day reporting on the industry around there. But that plant is very old. It dates back to the 1940s when it was
wow.
used for... Yeah, it was called Neches Butane at the time, and when I talk to people in the community around there, that's mm-hmm. pretty much what they call it. So
it goes back a ways. Has the facility ever or the company ever been cited or warned about potential safety risks? I mean, if we're talking about an old facility, I would imagine that simple upkeep and you know keeping with standards as they change and improve that would be a rather expensive affair.
That plant has been out of compliance several times with the Clean Air Act, and it was even cited for not reporting release events. It's paid several $100,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's one of the higher fines that some of these plants are made to pay. And it was out of compliance for almost a year last year, I believe.
Is it known? I mean, what are officials saying about what toxins might have been released as a result of this fire? Because as we've seen in past incidents, sometimes it's the discharge from the actual burning or the combustion of these chemicals that creates a problem in and around the facility.
Right. So I think that's an important point in the new development that we saw last night. Since Wednesday, EPA, TCEQ, the state environmental regulatory agency have been here. There's been over 2,000 on-the-ground handheld monitoring tests, and they've been running aircraft through the air that's been testing. And they haven't found any elevated levels of chemicals until Monday night, when they found elevated levels of VOCs, the volatile organic compounds that they really worry about, and also butadiene, which is registered as a cancer-causing chemical from the National Institute of Cancer.
So is anyone being evacuated? What about local or nearby residents?
Actually, kids went back to school yesterday after the initial evacuation on November 27th, and everyone kind of came home on that Friday. They said that there hasn't really been any issues. I talked to the principal and the superintendent at PNGISD yesterday, and they said, kids were mostly fine. But that one site where they found those elevated levels was right outside the plant.
This is a story that continues to develop, and Jacob Dick continues to follow it. He is a business reporter for the Beaumont Enterprise. Jacob, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard, and keep us posted.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's check with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday.
Hi, David.
Hello.
We're hearing more about the topic at the top of the show, the departure of a one Kamala Harris from the Democratic presidential primary. We have a big thread going on Facebook about the news there. Steve Bridges says, it's a shame that qualified candidates have dropped out before most voters even start paying attention, be it running out of money or the fact that the media overexposes those that perform well in debates and denies coverage to others. Our election process in this country is severely lacking in equity to all candidates. Matt Weiss says the big surprise is seeing qualified candidates like Harris leaving before candidates like Pete Buttigieg. And Susan D. Rayburn says she's disappointed for Harris, but common sense prevails. She says, I am, however, looking forward to seeing her grill Trump in the Senate, referring there to that potential impeachment vote and trial that would be underway in the upper chamber. We're also keeping an eye on reactions to that impeachment hearing on Capitol Hill today. I'll be back with lots more reactions to these stories from social media later in the show.
You know it. Of course, that depends on you, does it not, Texas? You need to get on social media. Your favorite platform will work, and tweet us or shoot us an email. Do whatever you need to do to let Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, know what's on your news radar on this Wednesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. We've talked previously on this broadcast about nurdles, tiny plastic pellets washing up on the state's beaches and the threat they pose to marine life. Earlier this year, a federal judge ruled that a company called Formosa Plastics, situated on Lavaca Bay, can be held liable for violating environmental laws. This after a 2017 lawsuit claimed the company dumped millions of nurdles into surrounding water. Now a volunteer effort to document the amount of plastic pollution in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere is getting a $1 million boost. Trey Shar of KUT Austin reports.
The money approved by a federal judge in Texas is part of a $50 million settlement with Formosa Plastics in a pollution lawsuit. Jace Tunnell is a director at the University of Texas Marine Science Institute and started the Nurdle Patrol, a group of citizen scientists who document how many of these plastic pellets, called nurdles, are littering coastlines. Tunnell hopes the data will convince the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality to ban plastics producers from allowing any of the pellets into the environment.
Currently, there's different languages and different permits across the country, but most of them allow for some pellets to be released into the environment, so we'd like it to say zero pellet loss.
The pellets can absorb harmful chemicals which endanger wildlife when they're mistaken for food. Other University of Texas researchers are looking for natural ways to speed up the breaking down of plastics in the environment. Reporting from Austin, I'm Trey Shar for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. Once upon a time, the winds began to blow and a tree came in contact with a power line. The sparks fell into the dry grass below, and as the wind kept gusting, the floor of the forest grew into a fire pit, spreading rapidly and becoming an historic blaze, one that would consume more than 34,000 acres and more than 1,500 homes in central Texas. Truth is, the Bastrop fire of nearly 10 years ago wasn't at all that unusual. I mean, just consider what California's gone through in recent months and years. But such nightmares might soon be a thing of the past. A team of Texas A&M researchers have developed a technology that can predict dangers years in advance. One of those researchers is Don Russell. He is a distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering, and he joins us now. Professor Russell, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Glad to join you.
I know that there is no silver bullet for these sorts of things, but a lot of people are raving about what you and your team have done here. What exactly have you come up with? It's a kind of a tool to help electric companies detect an outage before it happens?
That is exactly right. We have developed a smart system. It is a diagnostic tool. It's computer-based, that sits and looks at circuits on a continual basis and tells operators when those circuits are unhealthy. The distribution fault anticipation technology, as we've called it, allows operators to be told days, hours, days, weeks in advance. Sometimes we even have examples of several years in advance on blind studies we've done, where we know that things are in a failure mode and they can be found and fixed long before the catastrophic failure occurs.
Wow. Well, you know, I think a lot of folks heard about what happened out in California this year when PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, started doing these extended blackouts for no other reason than just to avoid the danger of live power lines snapping in the wind and causing fires. That was enormously inconvenient. It was worse than inconvenient. I mean, it created some, in some situations, life-threatening conditions, especially for those who rely on, say, home equipment for healthcare, that kind of thing. They were told they have no alternative. Does this technology now provide an alternative to those sorts of extended blackouts to avoid wildfires?
It does provide an alternative to some of the blackouts potentially. There are certain kinds of conditions, extreme conditions, where they're simply not possible to do anything except turn the power off. We have that even in the Gulf Coast of Texas, where we have hurricanes coming, mm-hmm. and there's nothing we can do to except turn the power off and wait. But one of the things that DFA will do is tell you if a circuit is absolutely healthy and nothing is going wrong. Mm-hmm. And if that knowledge is known by you, then you may well wait and not turn off the power to a circuit, because there are consequences to doing that.
Has this technology now been put in place, and how much does it cost?
We started a project in Texas funded by the state of Texas, several million dollars, back in 2012, after our devastating fires. And that was to develop the algorithms for the very purpose of wildfire mitigation. We already had the technology for reliability purposes, to help find and fix things so that you kept the lights on. But this 4-year project that we had funded by the state helped us to develop technology further for wildfire prevention. 7 utilities participated in that, and several of those utilities are rolling this out on their system as we speak, already have scores of feeders that have been where the technology has been applied, and have committed to the technology because it has helped them so greatly to find things early and avoid outages.
But of course, we have to factor in whether or not it's cost efficient. Because on the one hand, you know, if it costs too much, you're not going to have the power companies embracing this, because, well, there's, you know, you have to factor in the losses from, say, wildfires and lawsuits that might result as well, right?
That is correct. And this is actually very cost effective. The cost of installation of on a single circuit, which may serve several thousand customers, would be between $15,000 and $20,000. In the scheme of costs associated with electric utility operations, that's a very small number. If you look at what it would cost to put the DFA product on individual circuits at a utility, and you compare that to the cost of one wildfire, one major wildfire, it's far less to use DFA technology.
Well, I guess the good news is now you're going to be a rich man and you can retire, I presume.
Texas A&M University owns the technology. The commercialization of that technology, we hope, is a great success because this is going to be a great public benefit. No, I doubt seriously if I become a very rich man.
Well, one can always hope. Don Russell is a distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering at Texas A&M University. Part of a team of researchers come up with this new technology that can predict dangers along the line years in advance and perhaps prevent that next wildfire from ever occurring. Professor Russell, thanks so much for taking a few moments out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Glad to speak with you.
Yeah, that's interesting stuff. Well, the man who once famously sang "Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die" now says he's giving up weed, lest it kill him. NBC News reports that Willie Nelson, one of the original country music outlaws, has decided to give up smoking pot in order to improve his health. He's recently had to pause his usually busy touring schedule due to health issues. Now he tells NBC, quoting here, "I've abused my lungs quite a bit in the past, so breathing is a little more difficult these days, and I have to be careful. I don't smoke anymore. Take better care of myself," close quote. This is a rather big life change for the 86-year-old, considering that his use of and advocacy for the legalization of recreational cannabis has been part of his identity for so many years. The good news is that he's doing well, and he's back on the road again. No word on whether he packed any snacks. Oh, come on, you were thinking the same thing. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Five Texans sitting on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee are hearing witness testimony in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry into President Trump. In her opening statement, Stanford University law professor Pamela Karlan compared Trump asking Ukraine to investigate a political rival to him asking a favor from a governor for disaster assistance.
Imagine living in a part of Louisiana or Texas that's prone to devastating hurricanes and flooding. What would you think if you lived there and your governor asked for a meeting with the president to discuss getting disaster aid that Congress has provided for? What would you think if that president said, "I would like you to do us a favor. I'll meet with you and I'll send the disaster relief once you brand my opponent a criminal."
Three Democrats and two Republicans from Texas sit on the House Judiciary Committee. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is opening a new detention center in rural West Texas. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Troval reports federal officials need the space for an increasing number of detainees.
The new facility in Anson, Texas, will hold up to 1,000 detainees awaiting immigration proceedings, according to ICE. The detention center is set to open next week and will be managed by the private firm Management and Training Corporation. The facility was built by the state of Texas in 2010 to house inmates, but has never been used. ICE currently detains more than 52,000 people nationwide. Data from Syracuse University show the number of ICE detainees has increased about 30% over the past 2 years, and an increasing share of those detainees have no prior criminal convictions. I'm Elizabeth Troval in Houston.
The Brownsville City Commission is setting up its first ever LGBTQ task force. TPR's Ronaldo Leonis Jr. reports on the commission's unanimous decision last night.
Joe Colonuvias is a local activist from Brownsville and proposed the task force. He says he got the idea after several recent incidents targeting members of the LGBTQ community, including the harassment of a gay man at a local restaurant.
An employee of the restaurant made homophobic remarks towards this community member. Ultimately, the Brownsville Police Department was involved. They did make a report, but because in Texas we don't have any protections for our community, there really was nothing that could be done.
Colonuvias says he's glad the city passed the proposal and is happy to see Brownsville join cities like Austin, San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas, which have similar LGBTQ advisory boards. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Brownsville.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner faces a runoff later this month against a millionaire trial attorney in what will likely be, win or lose, a defining moment in Turner's political career. And it's been a long one. He's been at this politics thing since at least the 1980s. Indeed, he spent time serving in the state capitol, you may recall. But another defining moment during Turner's mayoral tenure looms large over his reelection bid. Mike Morris has been writing about it as City Hall reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Mike, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What is this defining moment during Turner's mayoral tenure that could affect his reelection prospects here?
Well, I mean, Hurricane Harvey is undeniably the largest single event of Turner's, you know, now 4 years in office. You know, the largest rainstorm ever to hit the continental United States. And there are thousands of Houstonians who are still trying to make repairs to their homes, and thousands more who hope that the city or county or someone will be able to put them less at risk the next time one of those storms rolls ashore.
And as I understand from what you've been writing for the Chronicle, Mayor Turner's opponent, Tony Busby, is pushing rather hard on a claim that Turner's let a lot of Houstonians down since the storm.
Yeah, the numbers are not great for the city. City officials have acknowledged for some time that they are no better prepared for a large storm than they were when Harvey hit, in terms of the flood control infrastructure that has been able to be built since that storm a little more than 2 years ago. City officials say that, you know, they don't have the money in their coffers to do the multi-billion dollar investments that are needed by themselves. You know, the comparable example is Harris County voters, the county that contains Houston. County voters approved a $2.5 billion bond on the one-year anniversary of Harvey, and the county flood control district has a lot of projects underway from that. But even on that end, with that significant pot of local funding, there's comparatively few large infrastructure or flood control projects that have been completed. It's been a credible criticism throughout the campaign that the city also has made very little progress on the housing repair front.
Yeah, I was reading that the city has just helped 71 homeowners through a home recovery program out of what? How many people whose homes were severely damaged or destroyed?
Well, the count of housing units is well north of 150,000, but
wow,
the number of people that are expected to be helped through this main recovery program that's funded by the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, is expected to number 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, people got cash from FEMA. People, in almost no cases, was that enough to make large repairs. But people also got help through an initial FEMA program that was very small. There was a FEMA program early on that was a little bigger that helped almost no one, 250 families in the city, roughly. So really, it's this pot of money from HUD that arrived about a year ago. The pace at which they have put that money to use has not really been to anyone's liking.
Mike, we're out of time, but I have to ask. I mean, on the one hand, someone hearing all of this that might say, this is just politics as usual. How much could Mayor Turner have done differently that would have led to better outcome?
Well, that is part of the struggle, and I think it's part of the reason that Tony Busby, his opponent, has not made it his chief issue in the campaign, is that it is a complex issue. It's not all on the city. The city is reliant on the state and the federal government in the Harvey recovery, and that is true today. It was true yesterday, and it'll be true tomorrow.
Mike, is the Republican showing signs of actually beating the incumbent Democrat here in this race?
I don't think most people expect Busby to come out on top. Turner's showing in November was in the high 40s, which when you're facing an opponent who was able to invest about $10 million in the race, certainly Busby and his camp would have wanted Turner's showing to be below 47%, I believe it was, spending that kind of money on the campaign.
And we'll find out how all this is settled come Saturday the 14th. Mike Morris will be covering it. He writes for the Houston Chronicle. Mike, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
We're approaching 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's a whole lot more of the Standard just ahead, so stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm Sabrina Ellis with Sweet Spirit and a giant dog. Going strong. A giant dog used to go down to Laredo, and the club was so close to the border that if you missed your highway exit, you would end up in Mexico. And we would arrive at this club, and it was a dive bar like anywhere else we would play, but we'd get an escort, like a security guy. We would get rock star treatment in Laredo because those people rock so hard on the border, and I can't wait to go back. It's been a few years since I've been there, but that was hands down my favorite place to play while a giant dog was coming up. Giant dog's a little darker and dirtier, and Sweet Spirit's what I would consider kind of everybody's like base humanity of wanting to hear pop music, wanting to escape their life a little. My most recent baby is Sweet Spirit. I kind of get to live a double life because I get the comfort and warmth of Texas, but I also travel most of the year. Coming home, it's like when you come home from work and you take off your shirt and you're like, now I'm gonna take off my bra. It's been sticking to you all day, and you take it off and you're like, oh. That's how it feels to drive back into Texas when you've been on a long tour. We do have a country song. It's very Loretta Lynn inspired. That song to me is actually more about finding independence long after heartbreak. After you've already felt that ebb and swell and life is over and crawling back in, just this feeling like being a stranger to yourself, and it's almost a relief. So I hope that song isn't just sad, but also a little bit liberating. my friend, she's from Australia, and she told me she cries every time she hears that song because it reminds her of how she's had to move around a lot in her life. To bring emotion to somebody else with a song that's actually a personal experience song, those little revelations to me are like, yeah, that's why it's okay that I spend all my time in dive bars. That's why it's okay that I spend all my time with my best friends and that beer is a big part of our career because people can relate. I got the answer here inside of myself. My name is Sabrina Ellis, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. The Texas Standard.
Sabrina, you always make me laugh. 44 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Asylum seekers detained in many parts of West Texas and New Mexico can have a hard time finding legal representation. Yesterday, we heard about some of the barriers they face. Well, today, KERA's Mallory Falk looks at a new collaborative trying to fill what they see as a legal gap.
Legal assistant Elena Vermeulen is squeezed into a car with three other volunteers.
So we're going to Otero. It's in Chaparral, New Mexico.
It's about half an hour outside El Paso and home to the Otero County Processing Center, an immigration detention facility.
We're truly in the middle of nowhere. There's a mountain range right before us.
Vermeulen and her colleagues are in for the week from California. They're here to help out with the newly launched El Paso Immigration Collaborative, also known as EPIC. Susan Beatty's an immigration lawyer and says today they'll talk with asylum seekers detained inside Otero.
We'll meet with them one at a time for about, 15, 20 minutes and talk to them about, why they fled their home countries, their experience entering the United States, their experience in immigration custody since they crossed in.
Some of these interviews will take place through thick planes of plexiglass over crackling phone lines. Then the volunteers will bring that information back to EPIC to determine whether the people they've talked to may be eligible for bond or parole and in need of legal representation. The group pulls up to the squat beige facility.
Now we're parking. I'm going to get our stuff ready and head inside.
Otero is one of five detention centers in the El Paso sector, which covers West Texas and New Mexico. It's a large jurisdiction with a lot of need and a limited number of lawyers.
The point of EPIC is to try and essentially crowdsource the issue of representation in these detention centers.
Allegra Love directs the Santa Fe Dreamers Project and is one of the leaders behind EPIC.
We're calling it super massive collaborative representation.
Volunteers, like the crew from California and local university students, visit detention centers and conduct legal screenings.
And then we have partnerships with national law firms and national agencies that are hooking us up with remote pro bono attorneys so we can bring representation to as many people as we possibly can to get them released.
This getting released part on bond or parole is key. Outside of detention, it's far easier for asylum seekers to get legal services. And they can do that in parts of the country where they'll face better odds in immigration court. Asylum denial rates in the El Paso sector are some of the highest in the country. Beyond release, EPIC has a second goal. The group says it's meticulously tracking data to get a better sense of what's happening inside detention centers. Collaborative member Ian Philibom with Innovation Law Lab says EPIC can potentially use this data to push for systemic change.
The scales are tipped so heavily against an asylum seeker in this jurisdiction. And so by inserting legal assistance and by inserting immigration attorneys, and by looking at what happens in these spaces en masse, we push back against that imbalance in power, and we implement a healthier ecosystem for adjudication of these asylum cases.
Take, for example, says Allegra Love, judges denying telephonic hearings, which allow lawyers to represent their clients remotely.
We all know it's happening. We all have had it happen to us. We know it anecdotally.
Right now, though, it's just that, a story. But Love says EPIC can track those denials over, say, the course of a year.
When we have 1,000 data points on that, then it's something that we can actually use as a powerful tool to make things happen.
Like potentially filing a lawsuit. Love also hopes this model can eventually be replicated in other regions with remote facilities and limited resources. She notes Immigration and Customs Enforcement recently opened several new centers in rural Louisiana, another place where detainees will likely face the same challenges. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
What you might describe as some breaking news while we're on the air. New York Times reporting that hundreds of thousands may be losing access to food stamps as a result of a new rule that's just been announced as approved by the Agriculture Department. It's a story we're going to be following up on tomorrow here on the Texas Standard. You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Democratic U.S. Representative from Houston, Lizzie Fletcher, said this about pay equality, and I quote, "In Texas, Latinas make less than 45 cents for every dollar a man makes. That makes us 49th in the nation." Well, wait a minute. Are those figures true? Here to help us do the math, Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What prompted Fletcher to make this claim in the first place?
So Fletcher said this in a tweet. She shared it on Latina Equal Pay Day, which was at the end of November.
I see.
And Latina Equal Pay Day marks the date in 2019. It's how long into 2019 a Latina in the United States would have to work in order to be paid the same wages her white male counterpart was paid last year.
Oh, wow.
So this year it was on November 20th.
Wow.
And Fletcher shared this tweet as part of a push to get members of the Senate to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, which is legislation that would strengthen the Equal Pay Act.
Okay. But she seems to be focusing on Texas here, right?
That's right. Nationally, there are a lot of different estimates that we could look at. And if we want to have those figures for a comparison here, nationally, Hispanic women make 53 cents for every dollar made by white non-Hispanic men across the nation. Mm-hmm. And that's based on data that measures the median annual earnings for full-time year-round workers. And that's important to specify because there are a lot of different ways that we could look at this. You can look at your full-time workers. You can look at part-time workers. Mm-hmm. You can limit by occupation. There are a lot of different ways to adjust this and analyze it.
So how did you choose to analyze it?
So she was talking about Texas, of course, so we have to look for Texas figures, and her office provided a few different studies here. But I want to make sure that we're super clear. The language that she uses in her tweet and the language anyone uses when they're talking about this is really important because there's so many different ways to look at it. And you want to make sure that you're comparing apples to apples. If you change the language even a little bit, it can go from true to false. So language is really important.
Okay. Or what in particular are you talking about when you talk about the language?
So in her tweet, Fletcher compared wages for Latinas to wages for men, and she didn't specify that she was talking about white non-Hispanic men.
Oh.
And that's usually the comparison that you see here. But if we look at what she literally said in her tweet, and I looked at census figures for the same thing that I discussed earlier, the median wages for full-time year-round workers.
Okay.
If we look at that data in the context of her tweet, in 2017, the year with the most recent data available, Latinas in Texas, they made about 76 cents for every dollar men of all races made. So that's different than the figure that she shared in her tweet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But when I contacted, there's always a but.
There's always, I heard it coming.
When we contacted her office and asked for data to support her statement, they sent me several different studies, and all of those studies relied on the comparisons between Latinas and white non-Hispanic men.
Okay.
If we look at that data, as was shown in the articles they provided, it's clear that Texas ranks 49th in the nation in terms of having the widest pay gap for Latinas, as she said. Mm-hmm. And in Texas, Latinas make about 45 cents for every dollar made by white non-Hispanic men.
Okay. So it's not so much that the numbers are off. It's just who do you include in the comparison? That's really what it comes down to.
Right. And there's not a right or wrong way to make this comparison. It just depends what kind of point you're trying to make. She said men. She should have said white non-Hispanic men because that's the data that she was actually talking about.
I see. Now, once you take all that into account, I mean, is it too early now? Because I think I'm pretty clear that if I hear you correctly, that she seems to be pretty close to the mark,
right?
Right. She just needed to use a bit more clearer language when she was talking about this. And actually, after I contacted her office and asked them to clarify what she was referring to, she shared another tweet replying to her original one and said, quote, "Someone asked the question, so to be clear, the statistic refers to white non-Hispanic men."
Well, I think that seems to settle it.
Makes my job a bit easier.
So what is your rating on this claim about Latinas in pay?
We rated this claim mostly true.
Mostly true. That's PolitiFact's rating for U.S. Representative Lizzie Fletcher's claim that Latinas in Texas make less than 45 cents for every dollar that a non-Hispanic man, is that right?
A white non-Hispanic man.
A white non-Hispanic man makes. Madeline Meckelberg joins us every week from PolitiFact, Texas. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much for stopping in.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello there,
what
David.
What are you seeing out there in the social medias?
Well, returning to a story I mentioned on the show yesterday and one we got an update about in the news roundup, Republican Representative Rick Miller of Sugarland says he won't seek re-election after racist remarks came to light. As we noted yesterday, he said he had drawn two primary challengers in his diverse district simply because they were Asian. Well, soon after those remarks to the Houston Chronicle became widely reported, Governor Greg Abbott rescinded a previous endorsement he had made of Miller. And Miller later announced that he would not seek another term. All in all, a rather remarkable turn of events, all in about a day's time there.
Yeah,
one that's inspired a lot of comments on our Facebook page. There, Janice Hitchcock says, "It looks like Republicans are getting as skilled at self-defeat as the Democrats have been." Meanwhile, Philip White says Governor Abbott should be careful. Rescinding his endorsement for candidates who make racist remarks could set a dangerous precedent. Interesting comment that. And yeah, again, rather sort of unforced error, I guess you could say, going into the 2020 elections there for Texas Republicans.
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking about politics, speaking about Beto O'Rourke, we were talking about him earlier.
We certainly
in
were.
In the program. You know, another former leading light, a la O'Rourke, of Texas Democrats making a return. Wendy Davis making it official in her bid to challenge first-term incumbent Chip Roy.
I guess that means she's filed, right?
Yeah, in Texas' 21st Congressional District this morning, she tweeted, "Just filed," and included a photo of her flanked by dozens of supporters. And what looked like downtown Austin, I believe, there. So definitely one to watch for coming forward there, the race between Chip Roy and Wendy Davis, and one that's going to be really, I guess you could argue, a bellwether of these 2020 events, as it's, you know, the sort of a suburban district that's traditionally been a Republican stronghold. Well, I say traditionally, but it's a relatively new district. But one that those suburban style districts have been a Republican stronghold. But yeah, we're seeing Democrats confidently going in and making big challenges in those districts.
Yeah, Chip Roy, he did his duty there in San Antonio, officially launching his reelection bid there, filing period closing in. Story reported by the Austin American-Statesman just now, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick saying that he's confident that Donald Trump will carry Texas despite the Democrats' vow to turn Texas blue. He was there for the purposes of submitting the paperwork that would put one Donald Trump on the Texas Republican primary.
Yeah, pretty remarkable. Big, big Trump booster. And it's funny because I feel like we've heard a lot of, you know, conversation about what does this mean on Patrick's behalf, that he's been so so receptive to the Trump administration.
When
is
you
he
say
angling
now,
for something?
That was what I was wondering. Yeah. I mean, if people sort of
but if he's been angling, don't you think he's been angling for quite some time? I mean, I guess unless there's a second Trump term.
I don't know if you remember this, but several months back, he sort of poo-pooed all that stuff.
Yeah, saying he had the, what, he said something like, "I've got the best job imaginable, the best job ever here in Texas."
Right, right. Of course, that's not true. We have the best job.
Well, that's
Texas,
true. Or you know what? You know who may have the best job here? I'm looking at this headline from the Star-Telegram that was just shared in our Slack channel. Post Malone gives away free Crocs at the South Lake Chicken Express where he used to work.
You mean shoes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Post Malone, you know, the Dallas-based Dallas-area rapper, loves his Crocs and apparently loves the Chicken Express there in South Lake in the DFW region where he used to work. So the fans there getting their own, these limited edition Crocs from old Posty there.
Hey, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but listen, we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm Dave Brown along with Wells, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare. The Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.